This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, folks. We've got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to visit with Dr. Gregory Guerra, President of New Orleans Dental Association. Dentists throughout the metro area are raising concerns about a move in the Louisiana legislature to ban fluoride in drinking water. We'll dig deep into what is the issue with fluoride, what is the issue with the fluoride levels that we utilize in our drinking water. It is a natural element, and why the hoopla? It's been in our water for a long, long time. I know that there's some recent studies out there. We'll try to figure out what that all means with Dr. Gregory Guerra. Mark Krikorian joins us, Executive Director, Center for Immigration Studies. The Trump administration is proposing and offering to pay undocumented immigrants $1,000 to self-deport. They'd be able to use the U.S. Customs Border Protection app. They will preserve their right to re-enter the country in a legal way if they choose to do this. We'll talk about the actual cost of deportation and how much money could be saved with these alternative methods to deport individuals. We'll visit with Michael Williamson, the president and CEO of United Way Southeast Louisiana, and Jeannie Donovan, deputy director of Population Health and Disease Prevention, New Orleans Health Department. And we will be talking about unintentional shooting injuries and deaths of minors relative to firearms that are unsecured in the home, the car, and other places, and how we can go about trying to reduce that threat or happenstance. Andy Copeland visits us, president and CEO of the Greater New Orleans Foundation. Today is Give NOLA Day, May the 6th. We'll talk about Give NOLA Day and the importance to our community here at home. Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis joins us, senior fellow and military expert with defense priorities. Israel approved plans Monday to seize the Gaza Strip and to stay in Gaza for an unspecified amount of time. They are talking about flattening Gaza and to eliminate Hamas, move people to non-Hamas controlled areas of Gaza, to ultimately bring an end to this conflict. We'll get his thoughts on this and the bombings that are going back and forth between the Houthis in Yemen and the Israelis, and U.S. participation in that endeavor as well. Wanted to remind folks, Real ID starts tomorrow. If you look at your driver's license, if you see a star on the upper right-hand corner, that means you have it. A lot of people didn't realize they have it. In fact, it came up at a kitchen table conversation not too long ago at my house, and we were looking at people's IDs, and some folks didn't even realize they had the Real ID. They totally forgot about it. But tomorrow's the date. So if you're traveling, you will be stopped at TSA if you don't have a Real ID driver's license. There are alternative ID methods that you can utilize in place of Real ID, one being a passport. So just remember, think about this. If you are traveling this week, you are going to be faced with having that ID checked, and we'd hate for you to be turned around and miss your flight. And as we know, once you miss your flight, all things go crazy at that point in time and nothing is as much fun as it was originally intended to be, right? So just a little caution there. Talk about caution. One would think, one would hope that we would be able to better manage and utilize airspace in and around our nation's capital. This past week, two more planes were forced to abort landings because of Army helicopter flights flying to and from the Pentagon, moving political and military VIPs to that structure. Now, if anyone has ever flown into Reagan, you'll know just exactly how close the Pentagon is to the airport. There are some very tricky flight paths because of a number of restrictions, because of critical infrastructure in and around both sides of the Potomac, Washington, D.C. proper, and the other side of the Potomac, both Virginia and Maryland. And, you know, it's a big challenge, but one would think in light of the most recent tragic collision midair that this would have been resolved by now. But obviously it's not. And folks are getting pretty upset about it. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy said just this past Friday that Army helicopters took a scenic route. It was unacceptable, adding that he would speak with the Defense Department to ask why the hell our rules were disregarded. The Army spokesman disputed that the flight was scenic and says that the helicopter had been approved to land at Pentagon and was asked by the Pentagon flight tower to circle again before landing. Well, maybe that's a problem. If we have two flight towers managing flight in this highly restricted area, unless there's coordination between the two, Houston, we have a problem. The helicopter's second pass appears to have caused air traffic controllers at DCA to divert two plane landings, the Army spokesman said. They also said that the flight on Thursday was done in accordance with published FAA flight routes. Well, then that's a different problem, yet another problem, I should say. Why we can't get this under control is beyond me. And why there can't be, especially with helicopters, one approved approach to the Pentagon, no exceptions. I repeat, no exceptions. And if the weather is not favorable to that path, then you have to land someone else, somewhere else. And guess what? Do what everybody else does. Get in a car and then drive to the Pentagon. None of these people are important enough, in my view, maybe yours too, to put you, me, and the remainder of the flying public that are going into that airport at risk of dying. You at the Pentagon are not the center of any universe. What you do may be important, but it's not important enough to put the flying public at risk in and around Reagan National Airport. Plain and simple. And if we start from that premise, one would think that we should be able to resolve this issue. Now, members of Congress are upset about this. They want to get involved. And I would just point out to the Transportation Secretary and the Secretary to the Department of Defense, do you really want Congress involved? Really? You want this to become a three-ring circus? It's already a circus. So let's add a couple of more rings to this circus, right? Get in a room, get off Zoom, bring the folks that you need, and get this done now. We have additional pressures because we have a reduced workforce. of air traffic controllers working across this country. In fact, in Newark, it's so bad right now, they're actually canceling domestic flights. Newark's a big international airport. We really can't afford to eliminate Newark as an international airport on our eastern seaboard for a whole host of reasons, because there's not that many. And the fact of the matter is that they're actually putting warnings out about flying into Newark because of the shortages of air traffic controllers. This is a mess, coupled with antiquated equipment that we've never paid attention to, that we've not made the investments necessary in order to have the latest and greatest technology, which, interestingly, you will find where? In Europe. Go figure. Countries that don't have the GDP that we have, countries that don't have the political and economic oomph that we have, countries that seem to be more interested in protecting the lives of the flying public than we are in the United States. What a sad commentary. I thought we were the technological leaders in the world. But we are reminded day after day after day that we fall behind others. So what are we actually at the end of the day? I'm not sure. I'm beginning to wonder. Sometimes I believe if we just say it enough, we all believe it. But when we dig down into the granular details of a lot of the services that are being provided, we find that they don't actually match up to our expectations. And one, as we get on the plane, in the plane, right? There was a famous comedian that talked about that. I don't want to get on the plane. I want to get in the plane. Well, we get in the plane that we're going to be safe. This isn't about Democrats. This isn't about Republicans. This isn't about any of that. I'm sick and tired of the division, the finger pointing, the battling, the this, the that. This is about you. This is about me. And this is about the remainder of the traveling public in the United States and our international visitors that come to this country and dump off a lot of their money, which is a good thing for us. So let us hope that we can just get our act together for once here, sooner rather than later. This should not be so difficult. This should be one of the highest priority items that Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy has on his desk. It should be top of mind. And why we can't get our act together at that airport relative to military aircraft is beyond me. I'll say it again. We, collectively, as the taxpaying public, versus the military VIPs, all of the government VIPs in that area, when I'm flying into Reagan, my mindset is I and other taxpayers, we're more important than you. So do us a big favor. Just get the hell out of our way. Please. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. Israel's security cabinet on Sunday approved a plan to invade and occupy the Gaza Strip in what is being called an expanded ground operation. The plan is named Operation Gideon's Chariot. And Israelis are saying this mobilization is reportedly going to be one of the largest since the war began in October of 2023. And yes, they are using the word occupy. They are saying that they are finally going to occupy the Gaza Strip. Whatever land that they have, they will not give back, and they intend to keep. Joining us to talk about this is Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, Senior Fellow and Military Expert with Defense Priorities. Lieutenant Colonel, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So, Lieutenant Colonel, this—I guess it's fair to say this is a major shift in what they are saying and what their belief is about the next steps for them in this operation.
Well, it is definitely a big change because, you know, the Trump administration, since even before it came in, they had been working with the Netanyahu government to try and get a ceasefire, to try to get all their hostages back, to end the bloodshed, et cetera. You know, the original plan ceasefire was supposed to be a multi-phase, I think a three-phase operation that would end up over a medium period of time, number of weeks, would get all the hostages back in exchange for Palestinians to get some of their prisoners back from the Israeli side, et cetera. And then it was going to lead to a negotiated complete end to the war. And now then it's gone the exact reverse. After getting, you know, part of the first phase applied or executed, and they got some of the hostages back, then Israel said, well, now the Hamas side is backtracking on some of these things. So they said, now we're just going to go in. So all that had been accomplished there has now been ruined, frankly. And now here they're going to go back in on the ground. At the same time, they're also basically expanding the war to Yemen. They've been in Israel even today has launched some additional strikes into a port facility and an airport in Yemen. And of course, that doesn't have any indication it's going to be over anytime soon. And you have to ask the question, has Israel bitten off more than it can militarily chew? Because I frankly don't know what the attainable military objective is for Israel in this going back into the Gaza Strip, because, I mean, they didn't finish the job in 19 months in the first iteration, so I'm not sure why they think they're going to succeed this time.
So this is the outcome, what they have announced the other day. Your best guess, why now?
You know, that's one of the big questions here. Other than, you know, that many people have suggested that Israel never wanted peace in the first place. They didn't want the ceasefire in the first place because they don't want to negotiate an end. They want an outright military victory. And if that is the case, I think they're going to be sorely disappointed. And listen, part of the reason why the Israel side needed that ceasefire was because they were wearing out their reserve forces. Their system of military is not designed for long-term campaigns that extend into extended periods of time. They're made for short, sharp wars of decision, and then the reserve forces will go back home. These people were already refusing to show up to duty in larger numbers because it was ruining their lives. Now that they've specifically relied on tens of thousands of more reserve soldiers to be called up for this, and the government is openly saying that this is probably going to be a multi-month situation. They don't even think it's going to end soon, but I just don't understand where the likelihood of success is going to come when the fundamentals that caused them to basically get worn out the first time are still in effect. So this, frankly, is just kind of puzzling across the board.
In your mind, how would you characterize or identify or decide we've reached success in the elimination of Hamas? What would that look like? Because I have a little...
You know, listen, I
understand a little, I guess, I mean, not like you, but I understand a little of what's going on, but I'm having a real difficult time understanding what does success look like?
Listen, I'm telling you as straightforward as I can, Israel lost the chance to have success in the first couple of months of this war. I said early on, and now it is playing out exactly that way, that they are pursuing a course of action that cannot succeed militarily, and in fact is laying deep seeds of future instability for their own country. Because when you have killed so many innocent people and literally raised the ground, the ability of the entire strip of 2 million people even to survive and to live in anything other than an existent state, you are guaranteeing that the anger built up inside those, once this fighting stops, and the fighting always stops at some point, but the resentment built up here is going to cause the same fundamentals that led to October 7th in the first place to just be on steroids. So even if you somehow manage to kill literally every single member of Hamas, all of the rest of the male population, especially of all those who have lost children, and there's 30,000 children that have been killed in all of this carnage so far, I mean, they're not going to just lay down and be passive. They're going to look for an opportunity in the future. They're going to buy their time, et cetera. That's why I say these are seeds that are buried deep. And Israel is, I don't know how they're going to undo this for now. So if anybody thinks there's going to be a victory here, there could be a temporary one, but it is going to be a Pyrrhic victory.
I mean, I guess the only way, you correct me if I'm wrong, it's to statistically speaking, to have success is to go in and occupy in a permanent fashion and not even recognize it any longer, right?
Well, no, I mean, that's a band-aid.
I mean, you're going to be in conflict forever, but, you know, I mean, I guess it's just something that you decide on. Do I want to be in conflict forever? I don't know how heated it's going to be, and just go in and occupy it and take it over and call it a day.
Well, see, look, let's be blunt. Here's your options. You either go in and kill everyone or get them physically out and drive them wherever. I don't even know where in the world you could possibly send that many people. Or you're going to have to change your policies to recognize the existence of these people and find some way to possibly live together. Because if you don't, then you are building in long-term instability for Israel. I mean, the terrorist threat will remain because that's the only tool left to people when you put them in a situation like what the Palestinian people is. I know that's not a popular thing to hear, but that's what the Israelis have done for themselves right now. That's where they are.
And they've actually been there for a long, long time. And the opportunities given to the Arab nations to help or facilitate or provide sustenance here, I think Syria has backwalked on their agreement to take 2,000 or 3,000 of the orphan children into Syria. I think they've reneged on that deal. Or Jordan. It may be Jordan, excuse me. I think it's Jordan. Correct?
I have not heard that part. It could well be accurate. But, I mean, that's not even a Band-Aid. That's such a small number. I mean, you're talking 2 million people.
I'm just talking like figuratively, you know, these small wins that you could get to help the population, it's not happening. No one in the region is really stepping up.
Well, because what they're being asked to step up to is something that they find fundamentally unacceptable. They're basically being asked to participate in the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, and they say they're not going to do that. And the Palestinian people themselves say they don't want to. I'm sure that some number would leave if they had the chance, just to have some kind of chance to have a life. But it's clear that large numbers have staked it out. They say this is the land that we were born in. Our ancestors lived here, and for them, it's an existential issue that they're just not going to give up on. And as long as that's the case, you have basically two immovable objects on both the Israeli and the Hamas side, or the Palestinian side, rather. And unless the Israeli side is willing to do something different, there's no alternative left for the Palestinian people. That's the big point we need to understand.
Have we had any kind of similar friction points like this with two separate populations in a country fighting? I think there's been some in Africa, you may know better than I, that have ever we've achieved successful conclusion to this kind of conflict?
There certainly have been in times, I mean, like the Armenian Azerbaijan, I mean, that's still kind of rolling to this day. You certainly had the Houthis and the Tutsis in Africa, among others. And what has to happen is that the one or both sides finally have to burn down until they no longer can continue to resist, or they no longer can continue to keep up. If you're the more powerful side, like the Israelis are, they finally just get worn down and they say, this is just not worth it. But we're nowhere near that right now. So this has no end in sight. It will eventually burn out, because all conflicts do. But the carnage between now and then could just be catastrophic.
Yeah, I mean, I know that you got military experts like to look at history militarily, how these things kind of play themselves out. And I was kind of curious, has one ever reached a level of success, of what we would say success might be here? I couldn't think of any, and that's why I was kind of curious if there were any. Let us.
None that is certainly a model to go to. I mean, just to having a forest fire burn itself out, of course, leaves the forest destroyed. and then it takes, you know, generations to rebuild, even on top of that. And that's why I was saying from the beginning of this war that Israel needed to change its course and for the first time since 1947, find some way to give the Palestinian people even a reason to hope. Because if you don't have both sides of this have some plausible reason to tell their people there's a reason to hope in the future, you will guarantee neither side has peace or security going forward. That's the harsh truth.
Let's pivot real quick. Let's talk about Iran. And, you know, it seems to me that the Houthis in sending bombs into Israel almost nightly is really stoking the fire and not making the Gazan or the issue with Hezbollah in the north any easier, right?
Well, I mean, that depends on your perspective, because I actually had a guest on my show yesterday, the Daniel Davis Deep Dive, who said, listen, we need to understand that everybody doesn't fight the way we do, and they don't use the same calculations. He said, for example, many of these groups in the Middle East, they don't count victory as defeating the enemy militarily. They count victory as not losing. And so you see that in the Houthis. They've been doing this since 2015 with the Saudi Arabians had been trying to bomb them into the Stone Age. They never succeeded. And this isn't going to succeed either. It's very unlikely that now all of a sudden with both the U.S. and Israel pummeling different parts of the Houthis in Yemen, that suddenly they're just going to lay down now. I think that you're going to find that this is a generational struggle, just like we saw in North Vietnam. They were willing to pay millions of casualties and go on until we finally got tired. I think that you'll see a similar thing here. So if anybody expects it to change, they're going to keep fighting.
So is that to say that we can just assume that the Middle East for decades and centuries to come is going to continue to be unsettled?
Unless the Israeli side decides they want to change their policies. They are the ones that have the dominant military power. So they are the ones that can change this. Because remember, the whole thing with the Houthis, they didn't start doing this until the Israeli side invaded into the Gaza Strip in the first place last year in 2023. And they said that if you'll stop that and you'll withdraw, so will we. We'll stop these attacks. When there was a ceasefire, they were good to their word, and they stopped the attacks in the Red Sea. It was only when Israel went back in and started attacking that they said, all right, that's it. You're cutting off the food. Now we're going back to it. If you want that to stop, then the Israeli war can stop, and so will that. So it is tied to what the Israeli side chooses to do.
It's just kind of interesting to see how this is going to ultimately play out. I mean, I think all roads lead back to Iran at some point in time. I know there's been talk amongst the Israeli parliament as to whether or not they go after their nuclear capabilities and eliminate that possibility there for decades to come so that they're not having to face that, whatever the next challenge may be. And it just seems that just becomes a whole nother friction point, right?
Well, it is, and it's even worse. I mean, when you're talking, Israel's already on the verge of being overstretched, as I mentioned earlier in your show here, by going into the Yemen situation, by still doing things periodically in both Syria and in Lebanon. Obviously, the situation in both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And if you want to add the Iranians into it, I mean, that could literally lead to the defeat of Israel. You can't have that many enemies and think you can beat everybody. And listen, the big thing, the warning bell I keep hitting with a gong every time somebody mentions this, think about what happens next. You go in there with a bombing run and you blow up a bunch of stuff in Iran, you hit nuclear facilities or whatever, then what? What are you going to do next? And you know, you have Naftali Bennett, who is constantly saying this is a once-in-a-50-year opportunity to regime change. Well, if you don't bomb the regime to death, and you won't, then what? What do you do next? And even if you did somehow miraculously get all of the leadership, then what do you have next? Do you think that there's going to be the people who live there are going to suddenly go, yay for Israel and let's live in peace? Of course not. They're not going to do that. You're going to make the matter worse. And by the way, Israel or Iran, unlike these other appendages and proxy groups, they have the capacity to strike hard against U.S. assets in the area, American personnel, other oil facilities. I mean, they can make the place a living hell if they think that they're facing an existential crisis. Don't unleash that. Don't put them into a corner to where the only thing they have is to burn the place down because they can.
Yeah. I watched your podcast last evening, if you don't mind me just pivoting real quick to Ukraine. I found it really interesting. And there were a lot of things that you brought to the forefront for me that I didn't really wrap my head around. How much is the Ukrainian situation consuming these military assets that for even the allies of Israel to be in a position to actually share more with them when a lot of folks are sharing with both and everybody's kind of taxed? Would that be an overstatement?
Right now, people are starting to get tapped out. I assure you, I have some sources at the British Ministry of Defense. It said many of their key inventories of their own national defense weapon systems and ammunition categories are depleted, to use his word. They're scrambling trying to get that done. But they just don't. And that's the UK. And, you know, and they have more capacity to produce weapons than nearly anybody else in Europe. So you can imagine other countries just don't have the capacity to maintain the stuff and keep their own inventories going in. And if you're talking about Israel now re-expanding the Gaza war. So they're already saying here's more months. So now then their ammunition needs are going to go through the roof. Somebody's going to have to provide that because they can't do it for themselves. And now that you have Zelensky saying he doesn't want to have a deal with Russia, he wants to keep fighting. He keeps asking for more weapons, more air defense systems, more ammunition, more money, et cetera. He doesn't want to have a negotiated settlement that they lose their territory. You know, you can understand his desire, but if there isn't the capacity to stop the Russians, then why would it make any sense for any Western country to say, we're going to keep giving you more and more ammunition that hasn't worked in now in the fourth year of war? Why do you think it's going to work now? And it's just a net loss. And look, math is going to play a part at some point. And you can't have the Ukraine side continue to fight, the Israeli side expanding this into the Gaza, maybe even into Iran. There's just not enough ammunition to go around. Something's got to give.
Yeah, I mean, I know that you get criticized a lot because you lay out kind of, you know, the facts, the unpleasant truths. I'll put it that way. About military capability, about the readiness of the military, as well as assets, you know, the bullets, the bombs, the missiles, the this, the that, that there's an end to that. And your consumption rate, and I guess what we're experiencing right now between these two conflicts, our consumption rate is not something that the EU, NATO, UK, USA can afford to keep funding. Is that fair?
Well, they can't. And, yeah, I certainly do take a lot of criticism for that, but I push right back because I'm just saying, you know, I'm not against any I'm not against anybody on our side. In fact, I'm for Israel. I'm for the United States. I'm for Europe. But I'm saying, fellas, reality counts and it matters. You can have this fiction and this what I call this made for TV script writing out of Hollywood of the ending you'd like to have. And that's fine. You can have your preferences. But when it comes to the hardcore truth and reality on the ground in your own defensive inventories against what you see on the other side, and Russia is through the roof, even according to our own General Cavoli, the head of Europe's U.S. European Command, in testimony last month, he said they're able to outproduce in every category, three times in the artillery shell, the capacity. It's off the charts with armored vehicles, infantry fighting vehicles, tanks, et cetera. All the key things that you need to wage a war, the Ukraine side and the entire Western side can't match what the Russians can do. So it's a math problem. And it doesn't matter how much you don't like math. The numbers are what they are, and they're going to eventually bite you. Don't wait until they've sunk their teeth into you before you finally give into it. Make a wise choice now while we still have lunch options.
Lieutenant Colonel, last question, and this is going to sound like an ignorant question. At the risk of sounding ignorant, I'm going to say it because a lot of this mystifies me. But are the Russians just more willing to accept casualties than we are? I mean, they're losing
Russia
a lot of people.
Russia considers this an existential fight, and they will put whatever cost it takes to secure themselves as they see their Western security, and they will pay whatever price it does. But they have millions more men to pay that price than the Ukraine side does.
And I guess the public there, a certain percentage of them just have this blind faith and trust in Putin, and all things are going to be good. I mean, their pain threshold is obviously much different than the U.S., right?
It is. But see, from the Russian side, they say this is an existential fight. It's the entire West. It's NATO against them, and openly so. It's not just against Ukraine. And they like, if we don't win this war, our very nation could be at risk. And so they say, you're coming after us economically, militarily, diplomatically. It's a full-on war for them. So they are willing to pay any price, and they have the capacity to win this on the ground if it goes long enough.
Folks, if you want to hear great conversations, you want to go to Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis's website, and they can find that where, Lieutenant Colonel?
Daniel Davis Deep Dive on YouTube. Just Google that, and it'll take you right there.
Daniel Davis Deep Dive. He gets some great guests, robust conversations, both sides of the issue. I love the debates. It's just a great conversation, and it's really a learning experience. It has been for me. Thank you so much, Lieutenant Colonel, for joining us today. Appreciate your time, your insight, and have a great week.
You bet. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, we'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. What I love about Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis, he gets down in the granular details as it relates to assets, the inventory of the weaponry. Kind of looks at it as a fighting man. I think he had a Bronze Star in Afghanistan, a very decorated officer. Very interesting, his conversations. Check it out. We will come back with Andy Copeland on our NOLA Coalition segment. It's Give NOLA Day today, and we'll talk about the benefits of giving on Give NOLA Day. And we'll also have the president and CEO of United Way, Michael Williamson, and others when we return. Stay with us.